Diejenigen, deren Verständnis nach Wronskis Meinung richtig war, verstanden.
From Saturday the 4th to Sunday the 5th of May, Reveille will embark on its 11th loop around the sun. Reveille is a collaborative sound and radio project presented by the SoundCap Cooperative that circles the Earth on live audio streams at daybreak. Reveille will be mixed from a hub at Stave Hill Ecological Park in South London and stations at Tartu, Sunshine Coast, Cagnat, and additional locations to be announced. You can listen online on Resonance Extra, Waveform, and other participating stations. For more information, please visit soundted.org/Reveille.
Im Grunde gar nichts, sondern verhielten sich nur, wie sich wohlerzogene Menschen bei allen komplizierten und unlösbaren Problemen, die das Leben von allen Seiten umgeben, eben verhalten. Sie verhielten sich mit Anstand und vermieden Anspielungen und unangenehme Fragen. Sie gaben sich den Anschein, als verstünden sie durchaus die Bedeutung der Situation, akzeptierten sie und billigten sie sogar, hielten es aber für unpassend und überflüssig, dies zu erklären. Wronski hatte gleich den Eindruck, dass Golenischew einer von ihnen war. Darum freute er sich doppelt über ihn. Tatsächlich verhielt sich Golenischew gegenüber Karenina, als er ihr dann vorgestellt war, so wie Wronski es sich nur wünschen konnte. Er vermied, offenbar ohne jede Anstrengung, sämtliche Gespräche, die zu Peinlichkeit führen konnten. Er hatte Anna früher nicht gekannt und war frappiert von ihrer Schönheit und mehr noch von der Schlichtheit, mit der sie ihre Lage hinnahm. Sie war errötet, als Wronski Golenischew hereinbrachte, und diese kindliche Röte, die ihr offenes und schönes Gesicht überzog, gefiel ihm außerordentlich. Aber ganz besonders gefiel ihm, dass sie sofort, wie mit Absicht, damit es in Gegenwart des Fremden ja keine Missverständnisse gebe, Wronski schlicht Alexei nannte und sagte, sie zögen beide in ein frisch gemietetes Haus, das hier Palazzo genannt werde. Diese geradlinige und schlichte Haltung zu ihrer Situation gefiel Golenischew. Sah er Annas gutmütig heitere, energische Art, kam es Golenischew vor, zumal er Alexei Alexandrowitsch und Wronski kannte, als verstünde er sie durchaus. Es kam ihm vor, als verstünde er, was sie selbst überhaupt nicht verstand, nämlich, wie sie ihren Mann unglücklich machen, ihn und ihren Sohn verlassen und ihren guten Ruf verlieren und sich dabei so energisch, heiter und glücklich fühlen konnte. »Er steht auch im Führer«, sagte Golenischew über den Palazzo, den Wronski gemietet hatte. »Dort hängt ein wunderbarer Tintoretto aus seiner letzten Schaffensperiode. Wissen Sie was? Das Wetter ist wunderbar. Gehen wir doch hin, schauen wir es uns noch einmal an«, sagte Wronski zu Anna. »Sehr gerne, ich gehe nur meinen Hut aufsetzen. Sie sagen, es sei heiß?« Sie war an der Tür stehen geblieben und blickte Wronski fragend an. Und wieder überzog ein leuchtendes Rot ihr Gesicht. Wronski erkannte an ihrem Blick, dass sie nicht wusste, in welchem Verhältnis er zu Golenischew stehen wollte und dass sie befürchtete, sie verhalte sich nicht, wie er es wünschte. Er schaute sie mit einem zärtlichen, langen Blick an. »Nein, nicht sehr«, sagte er. Und es kam ihr vor, als hätte sie alles verstanden, vor allem, dass er mit ihr zufrieden war. Und sie lächelte ihn an und ging raschen Schrittes zur Tür hinaus. Die Kameraden warfen sich einen Blick zu und auf beider Gesichtern zeichnete sich Verwirrung ab, als ob Golenischew, der offenbar entzückt war von ihr, etwas über sie sagen wollte, aber nicht wüsste was, und als ob Wronski sich das wünschte und es zugleich befürchtete. »Also dann«, begann Wronski, um irgendein Gespräch zu beginnen, »also hast du dich hier niedergelassen? Also gibst du dich noch mit demselben ab?« fuhr er fort, da ihm das Gerücht einfiel, Golenischew schreibe etwas. »Ja, ich schreibe den zweiten Teil der zwei Ursprünge«, sagte Golenischew, der bei dieser Frage puterrot geworden war vor Vergnügen. »Das heißt, um genau zu sein, ich schreibe noch nicht, sondern bereite es vor, ich sammle Material. Dieser Teil wird noch viel umfangreicher und wird fast alle Probleme umfassen. Bei uns in Russland will man nicht begreifen, dass wir die Erben von Byzanz sind«, begann er eine lange, hitzige Erklärung. Wronski war es zunächst peinlich, dass er den ersten Aufsatz über die zwei Ursprünge nicht kannte, von dem sein Verfasser zu ihm sprach wie von etwas Bekanntem. Aber als Golenischtschew dann seine Gedanken ausführte und Wronski sie nachvollziehen konnte, hörte er ihm, auch ohne die zwei Ursprünge zu kennen, nicht ohne Interesse zu, denn Golenischtschew sprach gut. Wronski verwunderte und bekümmerte allerdings die gereizte Erregung, mit der Golenischtschew von dem Gegenstand sprach, der ihn beschäftigte. Je länger er sprach, desto mehr entbrannten seine Augen, desto hastiger widersprach er vorgeblichen Gegnern und desto unruhiger und beleidigter wurde sein Gesichtsausdruck. Wronski hatte Golenischtschew als mächtigen, lebhaften, gutmütigen und hochsinnigen Jungen im Gedächtnis, im Pagenchor immer der beste Schüler. Darum konnte er die Gründe für diese Gereiztheit nicht verstehen und billigte sie nicht. Insbesondere missfiel ihm, dass Golenischtschew, ein Mann aus besten Kreisen, sich kommun machte mit irgendwelchen Schreiberlingen, die ihn reizten, und in Zorn geriet über sie. War es das wert? Das missfiel Wronski. Dennoch spürte er, dass Golenischtschew unglücklich war, und er tat ihm leid. Unglück, beinahe Geistesverwirrung, war auf dem beweglichen, ziemlich schönen Gesicht zu sehen, während er, sogar ohne die Rückkehr Annas zu bemerken, weiterhin hastig und hitzig seine Gedanken darlegte. Als Anna in Hut und Umhang eintrat, mit einer raschen Bewegung der schönen Hand mit dem Schirm spielte und neben Wronski stehen blieb, riss dieser sich erleichtert von den unverwandt auf ihn gerichteten klagenden Augen Golenischtschews los und blickte mit neuer Liebe auf seine betörende Freundin, die voller Leben war und Freude. Golenischtschew besann sich mit Mühe und war zunächst geknickt und mürrisch. Aber Anna, allem gegenüber wohlwollend, so war sie in jener Zeit, munterte ihn durch ihren schlichten und heiteren Umgang bald auf. Sie probierte verschiedene Gesprächsthemen aus, brachte ihn dann auf die Malerei, über die er sehr gut sprach, und lauschte ihm aufmerksam. Sie gingen zu Fuß bis zu dem gemieteten Haus und besichtigten es. »Über eines freue ich mich sehr«, sagte Anna zu Golenischtschew, als sie schon auf dem Rückweg waren. »Alexei wird ein schönes Atelier haben. Nimm dir dieses Zimmer unbedingt«, sagte sie zu Wronski auf Russisch und per Du, da sie schon begriffen hatte, dass Golenischtschew in ihrer Einöde zu einem nahestehenden Menschen würde und dass man sich vor ihm nicht verstecken müsste. Golenischtschew drehte sich rasch zu Wronski um. »Malst du denn?« »Ja, ich habe mich lange damit befasst und jetzt ein wenig angefangen«, sagte Wronski errötend. »Er hat großes Talent«, sagte Anna mit freudigem Lächeln. »Ich kann es natürlich nicht beurteilen, aber erfahrene Kunstkenner sagen das auch.« 8. Anna fühlte sich in dieser ersten Zeit ihrer Befreiung und raschen Genesung unverzeihbar glücklich und voller Lebensfreude. Die Erinnerung an das Unglück ihres Mannes vergällte ihr nicht das Glück. Diese Erinnerung war einerseits zu schrecklich, als dass sie hätte daran denken können. Andererseits schenkte das Unglück ihres Mannes ihr zu viel Glück, als dass sie hätte bereuen können. Die Erinnerung an alles, was nach der Krankheit mit ihr geschehen war, an die Aussöhnung mit ihrem Mann, den Bruch, die Nachricht von Wronskis Verwundung, sein Auftauchen, die Vorbereitung der Scheidung, an die Abreise aus dem Haus ihres Mannes und den Abschied vom Sohn, all das kam ihr vor wie ein Fieberwahn, aus dem sie, allein mit Wronski, im Ausland erwacht war. Die Erinnerung an das Böse, das sie ihrem Mann angetan hatte, weckte in ihr so etwas wie Ekel. Ein Gefühl, wie es wohl jemand empfindet, wenn er am Versinken ist und einen anderen, der sich an ihn klammert, wegstößt und der andere ertrinkt. Natürlich war das übel, aber es war die einzige Rettung. Und es war besser, sich an diese schlimmen Einzelheiten nicht zu erinnern. Nur eine beruhigende Überlegung war ihr damals im Augenblick des Bruchs zu ihrer Tat eingefallen. Und wenn sie jetzt an das Vergangene zurückdachte, fiel ihr diese eine Überlegung wieder ein. »Ich habe diesen Menschen unweigerlich ins Unglück gestürzt«, dachte sie, »aber ich möchte dieses Unglück nicht ausnutzen. Ich leide ebenfalls und werde leiden. Schließlich verliere ich, was mir am teuersten war. Ich verliere meinen ehrlichen Namen und meinen Sohn. Ich habe übel getan und will deshalb kein Glück, will keine Scheidung und werde an der Schande und der Trennung von meinem Sohn leiden.« Doch wie aufrichtig Anna auch leiden wollte, sie litt nicht. Von Schande keine Spur. Mit dem Taktgefühl, das beide in solchem Maße hatten, brachten sie sich im Ausland, da sie russische Damen mieden, nie in zweideutige Situationen und begegneten überall nur Menschen, die so taten, als verstünden sie das Verhältnis der beiden zueinander durchaus, besser als die beiden selbst. Die Trennung vom Sohn, den sie liebte, nicht einmal das bedrückte sie in der ersten Zeit. Das Mädchen, Wronskis Kind, war so herzig und nahm Anna, seit ihr allein dieses Mädchen geblieben war, dermaßen für sich ein, dass Anna selten an ihren Sohn dachte. Ihr Verlangen nach Leben, durch die Genesung noch gesteigert, war so stark und die Lebensumstände waren so neu und angenehm, dass Anna sich unverzeihbar glücklich fühlte. Je mehr sie Wronski kennenlernte, desto mehr liebte sie ihn. Sie liebte ihn um seiner selbst willen und um seiner Liebe zu ihr. Ihn ganz zu haben, war ihre ständige Freude. Seine Nähe war ihr immer angenehm. Die Züge seines Charakters, den sie mehr und mehr kennenlernte, waren ihr alle unsäglich lieb und wert. Sein Aussehen, nun verändert in Zivilkleidung, war für sie so attraktiv, als wäre sie ein verliebtes junges Ding. In allem, was er sagte, dachte und tat, sah sie etwas besonders Hochsinniges und Erhabenes. Ihr Entzücken über ihn ließ sie manchmal selbst erschrecken. Sie suchte nach Unschönem und konnte doch nichts an ihm finden. Sie wagte es nicht, ihn wissen zu lassen, wie nichtswürdig sie sich vorkam gegen ihn. Ihr schien, wenn er das wüsste, könnte seine Liebe bald enden, und nichts fürchtete sie jetzt so sehr, obwohl sie keinen Anlass hatte, als seine Liebe zu verlieren. Doch musste sie ihm einfach dankbar sein für sein Verhalten zu ihr, musste ihm einfach zeigen, wie sie ihn schätzte. Er, der ihrer Ansicht nach so deutlich zu staatsmännischer Tätigkeit berufen war, dazu eine wichtige Rolle zu spielen, er hatte ihr seine Ambitionen geopfert, ohne je das geringste Bedauern zu äußern. Er war ihr gegenüber liebevoll und respektvoll, mehr noch als früher. Und der Gedanke, sie dürfe die Peinlichkeit ihrer Lage niemals spüren, verließ ihn keinen Augenblick. Er, dieser mannhafte Mann, widersprach ihr niemals. Mehr noch, er hatte gar keinen eigenen Willen und war, so schien es, nur darauf aus, ihren Wünschen zuvorzukommen. Und das musste sie einfach schätzen. Obwohl seine ständig angespannte Aufmerksamkeit, die besorgte Atmosphäre, mit der er sie umgab, ihr manchmal zur Last wurden. Wronski indes war, obwohl alles, was er so lange gewünscht hatte, vollständig in Erfüllung gegangen war, nicht ganz glücklich. Er spürte bald, dass die Erfüllung seines Wunsches ihm nur ein Sandkorn von jenem Glücksberg verschaffte, den er erhofft hatte. Diese Erfüllung führte ihm den ewigen Fehler vor Augen, den Menschen machen, wenn sie sich Glück als die Erfüllung eines Wunsches vorstellen. In der ersten Zeit, nachdem er sich mit ihr vereinigt und Zivilkleidung angezogen hatte, empfand er den ganzen Charme einer Freiheit, die er früher nicht gekannt hatte, auch der Freiheit der Liebe, und war zufrieden, aber nicht für lange. Er spürte bald, dass in seiner Seele der Wunsch nach Wünschen aufkam, die Schwermut. Unabhängig von seinem Willen stürzte er sich auf jede flüchtige Grille, nahm sie als Wunsch und Ziel. 16 Stunden Tageszeit mussten irgendwie ausgefüllt werden, denn sie lebten im Ausland in vollkommener Freiheit, außerhalb der Gepflogenheiten des Gesellschaftslebens, das in Petersburg die Zeit ausfüllte. An die Vergnügungen eines Junggesellenlebens, denen Wronski sich auf früheren Auslandsreisen gewidmet hatte, war nicht zu denken, denn der einzige Versuch dieser Art hatte bei Anna eine überraschende und dem späten Souper mit Bekannten nicht adäquate Niedergeschlagenheit hervorgerufen. Mit der ortsansässigen und der russischen Gesellschaft war bei der Unbestimmtheit ihrer Situation ebenfalls kein Umgang möglich. Die Besichtigung von Sehenswürdigkeiten hatte für ihn als Russen und klugen Menschen, zumal alles längst besichtigt war, auch nicht jene unerklärliche Bedeutsamkeit, welche Engländer dem zuzuschreiben pflegen. Und wie ein hungriges Tier nach jedem zufälligen Gegenstand schnappt, da es Nahrung zu finden hofft, so stürzte sich Wronski vollkommen unbewusst bald auf die Politik, bald auf neue Bücher, bald auf Gemälde. Da er von jung an eine Begabung für Malerei gehabt hatte und da er, unschlüssig, wie er sein Geld ausgeben sollte, mit dem Sammeln von Gravüren begonnen hatte, entschied er sich nun für die Malerei, befasste sich damit und lenkte darauf den ganzen ungenutzten Vorrat an Wünschen, der nach Befriedigung verlangte. Er hatte Kunstverstand und die Begabung, Kunst treffend und mit Geschmack nachzuahmen. Und er meinte, das zu haben, was ein Künstler braucht. Und nachdem er eine Zeit lang geschwankt hatte, welche Art von Malerei er sich aussuchen solle, die religiöse, historische, die Genremalerei oder die realistische, ging er ans Malen. Er hatte für alle Malarten Verständnis und konnte sich von der einen wie der anderen inspirieren lassen. Doch konnte er sich nicht vorstellen, dass man gar nicht zu wissen braucht, welche Arten von Malerei es gibt, und sich unmittelbar davon inspirieren lassen kann, was in der eigenen Seele steckt, ohne sich darum zu kümmern, ob das zu Malende zu einer bestimmten Art gehört. Da er das nicht wusste und sich nicht unmittelbar vom Leben inspirieren ließ, sondern mittelbar von einem Leben, das bereits in Kunst verkörpert war, ließ er sich sehr rasch und leicht inspirieren und erreichte ebenso rasch und leicht, dass alles, was er malte, jener Malart, die er nachahmen wollte, sehr ähnlich war. Mehr als alle anderen Malarten gefiel ihm die französische, anmutige und effektvolle Kunst. Und in diesem Stil hatte er ein Porträt Annas in italienischem Kostüm zu malen begonnen, und dieses Porträt kam ihm und allen, die es sahen, sehr gelungen vor. 9. Der alte verwahrloste Palazzo mit hohen Stuckdecken und Fresken an den Wänden, mit Mosaikböden, schweren gelben Damastvorhängen an den hohen Fenstern, mit Vasen auf Konsolen und Kaminen, mit geschnitzten Türen und finsteren Sälen voller Gemälde. Dieser Palazzo hatte, nachdem sie dorthin übersiedelt waren, allein durch sein Aussehen in Wronski die angenehme Verblendung bestärkt, er sei weniger ein russischer Gutsbesitzer und Stallmeister außer Dienst, als vielmehr ein gebildeter Liebhaber und Förderer der Künste. Dazu selbst ein bescheidener Künstler, der sich zugunsten der geliebten Frau von Gesellschaft, Beziehungen und Ehrsucht losgesagt hatte. Diese Rolle, einmal erwählt, gelang ihm nach der Übersiedelung in den Palazzo vollkommen. Und als er durch Galernischews Vermittlung einige interessante Persönlichkeiten kennengelernt hatte, war er in der ersten Zeit ruhig. Er machte unter Anleitung eines italienischen Malereiprofessors Studien nach der Natur und befasste sich mit dem Leben im mittelalterlichen Italien. Dieses Leben im mittelalterlichen Italien bezauberte Wronski in jüngster Zeit derart, dass er sogar Hut und Plaid wie im Mittelalter über der Schulter trug, was ihm sehr gut stand. »Wir leben hier und wissen von nichts«, sagte Wronski einmal zu Galernischew, als dieser eines Morgens zu ihm kam. »Hast du das Bild von Michailow gesehen?«, fragte er, reichte ihm die erst morgens eingetroffene russische Zeitung und deutete auf einen Artikel über einen russischen Maler, der in derselben Stadt wohnte und ein Bild beendet hatte, über das seit langem Gerüchte im Umlauf waren und das schon im Voraus gekauft worden war. Der Artikel enthielt Vorwürfe gegen Regierung und Akademie, weil es diesem bedeutenden Künstler an jedem Ansporn und jeder Hilfe mangelte. »Ja, habe ich«, erwiderte Galernischew. »Selbstverständlich mangelt es ihm nicht an Talent, doch geht er in eine völlig falsche Richtung. Immer noch diese Einstellung zu Christus und zur religiösen Malerei à la Ivanov, Strauss und Renan.« »Was stellt das Bild dar?«, fragte Anna. »Christus vor Pilatus. Christus ist als Jude dargestellt, mit dem ganzen Realismus der neuen Schule.«
»Big fight, round two without play, until about a winner call. George, George, George. Four man. Say, hey man, how you doing? Fine. Damn right. Right on. Beef and bop and boof and bop and poof. Joe Frazier to the ground. Too bad it. And what did you say? I told you something. And boom and bravo color. George Fullman, I did a shoot man, I really didn't know, I used to say it was you, the man that was where I see I was wrong, I'm gonna tell them about the song and I will sing my song to tell you something, ha! Poof, bap, poof, poof, me and butter you were wrong. Hey, George, what you saying? You damn right.
ride it on until the sun until the sun until the bubble bubble ring ring. Please call the National Stadium. We down to make a wish, I was there. Until there's something, until there's something, until the bubble bubble call. Sure, man. Charge full man. I didn't really know this bubble was a big ring, cause I'm the bubble call. Fraser, too bad, eh? Boof, baff, boof, boof. Boof, baff, boof. I'm baby butter, you around. That's what him said. George says so. Don't go teach him what bubble call. George full man. Heavyweight champion of the world. As I will tell it to you, everyone. Bubble bubble call until there's something. That was really the thing, cause you didn't know. Until there's something, until there's something. Do you? Do you want it? She comes with something. And then my teeth don't bother ting. And I'm gonna swing on window ringing on her. Ting call, charge full man. Pull, I'm beef and baba. I'm beef and poof. 1, 2, 3. My God. Two freezer to the ground as I was there. I'm beef and baba and poof. John Fullman bustling down. You don't know to the ground as I was there.
Hardest part to deal with. The pain is unbearable. We lost everything. The war destroyed everything.
In the frenzy of war, culture and art emerge as a reflection of our collective understanding and experiences. Over 5,000 songs written about the Vietnam War left us with a lyrical testament that tells the story of a human side of the war, a story closer to the common people's experiences. This is a cultural history of the Vietnam War. My name is Beatriz de la Pava, and this is the documentary for the BBC World Service. As the helicopters roared over dense jungles and rice paddies in Vietnam, a counterculture movement was emerging somewhere else in the world. It's all over. It was a time when the clash of ideologies and the clamor for change reverberated across continents.
Make a grave for the unknown soldier, nestled in your hollow shoulder. The unknown soldier.
The Vietnam War, the American War of Aggression, or the White Man's War, as Americans, Vietnamese, and African Americans refer to it, has a soundtrack unlike any other war in history. It fed into a myriad of social changes and upheavals that motivated artistic expression. After the colonial French left, Vietnam was divided in two. The North, led by Ho Chi Minh and the Communist Viet Minh, wanted to unite the country. The South, supported by the United States, wanted to remain anti-communist and independent. Although President Kennedy initially refused to send troops to Vietnam, he eventually gave in with what he described as a new flexible way to confront and contain communism. Limited war.
This is another type of warfare. New in its intensity, ancient in its origin, war by guerrillas, subversives, insurgents, assassins, war by ambush instead of by combat, by infiltration instead of aggression.
Kennedy hoped to use a type of special forces trained in guerrilla warfare, the elite Green Berets. Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler, who was training to be a medic, celebrated the work of these units in a patriotic song.
I think you'll find this one of the most haunting melodies and lyrics that you have ever heard in your life. Ladies and gentlemen, Staff Sergeant Barry.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret.
This is a segment of an interview Ed Sullivan did with Staff Sergeant Barry Sadler.
Let me ask you one more thing. We've had a lot of demonstrators and a lot of people burning some draft cards. How do you feel about it personally?
Well, the right to demonstrate is guaranteed by the Constitution. I think it's a small group with a big mouth. And with burning draft cards, I personally feel that they're traitors and ought to be sent to the pen.
Put silver wings on my son's chest. Make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day.
This was one of the few popular patriotic songs about the Vietnam War era that casted the military in a positive light, to the point that it remained as the number one song of the Billboard Hot 100 for 5 weeks, the year of its release. Not long after, Kennedy doubled funding for South Vietnam's army. He also authorized the use of napalm and the spraying of the foliage to destroy the crops that fed their enemies.
Drop some napalm on the barn. It won't do much harm. Just burn off a leg or an arm. Napalm sticks to kids.
Napalm Sticks to Kids, a song created by Covered Wagon Musicians, which was a group of active GIs and Vietnam veterans who were against the war and against the indiscriminate use of napalm.
CIA with guns for hire, Montagnards around the fire, napalm makes the fire higher, napalm sticks to kids.
A whole array of chemicals was used, including Agent Orange.
Oh, the army tried some fancy stuff to bring them to their knees, like Agent Orange defoliants to kill the brush and trees. We'd hike all day on jungle trails through clouds of poison spray. And they never told me then that it would hurt my health today.
Country Joe McDonald wrote this song reflecting on the negative impact that the use of Agent Orange had during the war. And he told me a bit about those days.
I was protesting the war and I was being social political in my songwriting. But it was a period of people singing along with songs and playing acoustic guitars and guitars. It was very popular, probably with Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and other people, you know, being folk singers, singer-songwriters. And it served as a way to bring people together. That's when the term protest music was established.
Well, my children both had birth defects and the doctors had their doubts. They never could understand it, but I think I've figured it out.
Country Joe McDonald wrote songs throughout his career that chronicled the Vietnam War, often from the perspective of soldiers and veterans. And in this song, he talks about the horrible damage Agent Orange did during the war, and the damage it continued to do decades after the end of the war.
So my songs protesting the war were really in the minority. Songs supporting the war were in the majority. But in the long run, those songs have disappeared, and what remains, that genre of Vietnam War protest music, still is alive today. And that was a big difference between me and other songwriters. I was the only musician of the era to talk about being a military veteran.
This Agent Orange from Vietnam, we carry it with us still. It stays inside for years and years before it starts to kill. You might get cancer of the liver, you might get cancer of the skin. You can file for disability, but you might not live to win.
President Kennedy quietly continued to increase the number of American military advisors who were not only teaching the Army of the Republic of Vietnam to fight a conventional war, but ended up having a more active role. A clear violation of the agreement that had divided Vietnam back in 1954. What most Vietnam songs released during Kennedy's presidency expressed was a reluctance to be drafted.
There was a group of four rock and roll singers standing out in the corridor at the draft board, standing out there in their underwear, looking rather cold and miserable and unhappy, and singing a song that kind of expressed the sentiments of everybody who was there. And this is the song, the rock and roll song that we heard at the draft board.
As the Gold Coast Singers expressed in their song, Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Please, Mr. Kennedy, oh, well, well, I don't want to go, whoa, 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 a bang, bang. Don't want to go, I'm too young to die yet. Well, I ain't gonna smoke that last cigarette. Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy, oh, well, well, I don't want to go. Whoa, 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 a bang, bang. There's a good chance for that if you send Lyndon Johnson back. Whoa, please, Mr. Kennedy, oh, well, well, I don't want to go.
Mr. President, a Republican National Committee publication has said that you have been less than candid with the American people as to how deeply we are involved in Vietnam. Could you throw any more light on that?
We have increased our assistance to the government, its logistics. We have not sent combat troops in the generally understood sense of the word, so that I feel that we are being as frank as the as we can be. I think what I have said to you is a description of our activity there.
As far as most Americans knew, the United States was achieving its goal, a stable, independent, and anti-communist state in South Vietnam. But let's remember that the Vietnam War was the first televised conflict in history. And in June of 1963, the images of a Buddhist monk setting himself on fire on the streets of Saigon reverberated around the world.
A struggle of another sort was born in the Buddhist temples of Vietnam. The country's religious majority claimed oppression by the Catholic minority. They chose a violent and grisly form of protest. Suicide by fire. A flaming death that effectively brought the world to attention.
It was Thich Quang Duc who set himself on fire and burned to death in complete silence as a protest against Buddhist persecutions by the Catholic Vietnamese government of President Diem.
But it made no impression on the government, least of all Madame Nu.
What have the Buddhist leaders done comparatively? The only thing they have done, they have barbecued one of their monks.
500 monks and nuns were arrested. Students joined the Buddhist protest and were arrested just as quickly. The Diem regime charged that the Buddhists had joined a communist alliance to overthrow the government. The domestic revolt was a potent threat to the war against the Viet Cong.
This event damaged the relationship between the United States and the South Vietnamese government.
Washington became increasingly concerned that the religious issue would jeopardize new anti-communist military campaigns. The beginning of the end came with a grave warning from President Kennedy in this interview with Walter Cronkite.
I don't think that unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them, we can give them equipment, we can send our men out there as advisors, but they have to win it, the people of Vietnam, against the communists. But I don't think that the war can be won unless the people support the effort. And in my opinion, in the last 2 months, the government has gotten out of touch with the people. The repressions against the Buddhists, we felt, were very unwise.
At the time of Diem and his brother's assassination, Diem was widely considered to be a corrupt dictator, as folk singer Phil Ox reflected in his song, Talking Vietnam Blues.
Well, I walked through the jungle around the bend. Who should I meet but the ghost of President Diem? Said you're fighting to keep Vietnam free for good old Diemocracy. That means rule by one family and 15,000 American troops, give or take a few thousand American troops. He said I was a fine old Christian man ruling this backward Buddhist land.
The regime of South Vietnam's president, Ngo Dinh Diem, comes to an end in a wave of violence. A few days before the army revolt, these last pictures showed a man who seemed to have no premonition of the horrible death he was to meet. For 2.5 hours, the palace comes under heavy bombardment before the white flag is raised. Meanwhile, Diem and his brother, Ngo Dinh Nhu, had fled the palace in disguise. They were later captured, only to die in an armored car that was taking them to prison.
Well, now old Diem is gone and dead. All the new leaders are anti-red. Yes, they're pro-American freedom sensations against Red China and the United Nations. Now all the news commentators and the CIA are saying, thank God for coincidence.
Monday, November 4th, 1963. Over the weekend, the coup in Saigon took place. Culminated 3 months of conversation about a coup, conversation which divided the government here and in Saigon. I feel that we must bear a good deal of responsibility for it, beginning with our cable of early August in which we suggested the coup. I should not have given my consent to it without a roundtable conference in which McNamara and Taylor could have presented their views. I was shocked by the death of Diem and Nhu. The way he was killed made it particularly abhorrent.
18 days after, President John F. Kennedy was murdered. Lyndon B. Johnson became the new president of the United States. Meanwhile, the south of Vietnam saw 8 different governments between 1964 and 1965. All those Vietnamese leaders were very close to the American government, and that made them look as puppets in the eyes of a big portion of the South Vietnamese population, which led to the strengthening of the National Liberation Front, or the Viet Cong campaign, finding support in the people who lived in the countryside. Now, when we talk about the music in North Vietnam during this period, radio played a fundamental role. As the founding editor of the Vietnam War Song Project, Dr. Justin Brumer, told me.
When you look at Vietnamese music, you have to consider radio. Radio was very prominent in Vietnam. They had this amazing radio system where they had speakers throughout the city, in villages, because people didn't own their own radio necessarily. So they would broadcast the radio, and in these radio programs, they would have songs. So they actually had permanent orchestras and choirs to perform Vietnamese war songs. They usually refer to as red music. That's the classification that they gave it. And these songs are promoting anti-imperialism, communist principles, they're pro-soldier, but they're also peace songs. They talk about unifying the country. And these were broadcast in the cities, they're broadcast in the villages. So these were songs that were known by people.
Yeah. the South was a bit different. Almost a decade into the Vietnam War, the country was receiving a massive influx of American soldiers, bringing with them popular Western trance and musical styles. Doing my research, I found the music and story of Phuong Tam, a 16-year-old Vietnamese girl who sang morale-boosting songs for South Vietnamese military personnel.
In this Vietnamese officers' club, the war takes a backseat to the monthly dance.
After a while, Tam ditched the propaganda music and rose to the top of the nightclub circuit in Saigon as one of the country's first rock singers.
Anh là lính đã tình, tình non sông rất nặng, tình hai hồ ôm mộng.
But the songs she recorded back then went missing for decades after 1975, as her daughter Hannah told me.
I did not know that she was a recording artist. It made me look at her in a different light. And I became obsessed with trying to figure out this person that I've known for 55 years. Who is this person? And what I realized was that she was a teenage rock and roll singer. She was a teenage rock star. She was bringing rock and roll music into popularity. No one was really singing Vietnamese rock and roll. We call it Nhạc Kịch Đồng. I mean, at the time, it wasn't labeled Nhạc Kịch Đồng, but I think as time went on, it was realized that it's called action music, because when you hear the music, you just want to dance. The strange email that came to her asking her for permission to use the song in the movie, it opened up a secret or maybe a forgotten memory that my mom had for over 55 years. Life went on. She became a survivor of war and displacement. And the recording just became further and further from her memory.
I try to forget in my past, you know. I don't want to tell my husband and my kid. I never talk about my past, you know, never.
The history of Vietnamese music and culture and literature before 1975 was pretty much destroyed and forbidden and banned after the reunification of South and North Vietnam, because they wanted to create their new history. And so they destroyed a lot of what was before 1975. Because they didn't want any Western influence left in Vietnam. It's incredibly hard to find in any books about what the Vietnamese culture went through.
In a world divided by strife, music has the power to paint a vivid picture of the social, political, and cultural landscape of different historical periods. And in this case, music became a public space to reflect different perspectives on the Vietnam War. Up until now, you've heard how songs written during the first part of the war had a more patriotic feel and how it started to change once young people were being drafted. About the different relationships North and South Vietnam had with music and how it was a vehicle for propaganda, and why finding songs produced in Vietnam that talk about the Vietnamese perspective of the war are so difficult to find nowadays. But stay tuned for the second part of the Vietnam War soundtrack, as we still have over a decade of some of the music that chronicled the history of the Vietnam War. With me, Beatriz de la Pava.
This is the BBC World Service, where we explain the world around us.
from breaking the latest news.
And in the early hours, these are our main stories.
To an in-depth exploration of the stories that matter.
The human condition over the last several hundred years has improved a lot. Humans are very innovative.
We're right on the front line of the world stories.
We have a great deal to discuss about the events in the Middle East, how we got here, how events are unfolding on the ground.
On the picket line.
The strikes are not over in Hollywood.
And even the finishing line.
It's a pretty astonishing feat of athleticism.
We follow global events as they happen across every continent.
This is Delhi.
Here in West Africa.
Live from the BBC World Service studios in central London.
So that you know what's going on in the world, and even out of this world.
To see for the first time this material that no other human has seen before.
Your source of information and analysis, news from the BBC World Service.
Coming up in part two of the Vietnam War soundtrack, you'll hear about the role folk music and rock and roll played in the anti-war movement, interviews with the creators of songs like Eve of Destruction and Fortunate Son, a conversation I had with Kim Phuc, known as the Napalm Girl, and how a Christmas song played a fundamental part in Saigon's evacuation of the American troops. So join me, Beatriz de la Pava, after the news on the BBC World Service.
BBC News with Danielle Jaworowiecka. Health officials in Gaza say 100 Palestinians have been killed in the past 24 hours as the Israeli army strikes targets across the territory. The IDF says it's eliminated dozens of what it called terror operatives in Gaza City, while there's been fierce tank fire and airstrikes in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Reports from eastern Syria say at least 10 pro-Iranian militants have been killed in airstrikes. The UK-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the strikes are likely to have been carried out by the US. Since the war between Israel and Hamas erupted, such groups inside both Syria and Iraq have mounted more than 100 attacks against US targets. Ukraine has carried out a series of overnight airstrikes on targets in southwestern Russia. Moscow says two people were killed in the attacks. A large microelectronics defence factory was hit in the city of Bryansk. In the past few minutes, the governor of Belgorod said a strike hit a central city district, killing two children. Taiwan's three presidential election candidates have taken part in the only televised debate ahead of next month's elections. Many of the questions focused on Taiwan's difficult relationship with China. Pakistan's army says it's killed five militants, including a commander, in North Waziristan. There's been an increase in clashes in the area since the banned Pakistani Taliban ended a ceasefire with the government last year. Heavy rain and flooding have cut London's high-speed rail connection to Europe and caused disruption to other services. Eurostar says a tunnel has been flooded. And a qualifying match for the Brisbane International Tennis Tournament in Australia had to be suspended on Saturday after a deadly snake made its way onto the court. The game was paused for 40 minutes while the highly venomous eastern brown snake was removed. BBC World News.
Before we start, this episode contains some outdated language that may offend. You're listening to the second part of the Vietnam War soundtrack on the BBC World Service with me, Beatriz de la Pava. The songs that explicitly opposed the Vietnam War were not that common before 1964. But in August of that year, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution requested by President Lyndon B. Johnson marked a turning point.
I have been given encouraging assurance that such a resolution will be promptly introduced and passed with overwhelming support.
Politically, the United States could not invade North Vietnam because they hadn't declared war. But they did feel that they were able to bomb it, unleashing what would be known as Operation Rolling Thunder, a bombardment that ended up lasting 3 years.
I got a letter from LBJ. It said, "This is your lucky day. It's time to put your khaki trousers on. Though it may seem very clear, we've got no job to give you here, so we are sending you to Vietnam."
As U.S. troops increased from around 50,000 to almost 500,000 between 1965 and 1967, songwriters directed their anger at the president. One of them was Tom Paxson with his song Lyndon Johnson Told the Nation.
It was early in the Vietnam War, and it was the first song that I wrote in opposition to that war. And I wanted to be satirical. I wanted to make people laugh at the arrogance of thinking that we could change another country's government. People in my audiences have felt the same way I felt about the war, and they were glad to have a song taking an anti-war position and doing it humorously.
And when I asked Tom about how much influence he thought folk music had in the anti-war movement, this is what he told me.
I think it played an enormous role. All of us were doing anti-war concerts all the time. People like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. I don't know how much effect we had. Maybe none, maybe some. I think we were doing it for the sake of our own souls, to tell you the truth. It's hard to change history. So I think the best you can say is we tried.
Lyndon Johnson told the nation, have no fear of escalation. I am trying everyone to please. Though it isn't really war, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese.
Meanwhile, in Vietnam, Hanoi began to send North Vietnamese into the South for the first time. They were going down the network of paths they had created, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. This move led to another escalation, as Donovan immortalized in his song, The War Drags On.
Found himself involved in a sea of blood and bones. Millions without faces, without hope and without homes. And the guns, they grow louder as they made dust out of bones. That the flesh had long since left, just as the people left their homes. And the war drags on.
I also spoke to Barry Maguire, the man who sang one of the most emblematic songs of the anti-war movement in 1965, called If of Destruction.
People said that Eve of Destruction is a protest song. It wasn't protesting anything. It was just like a newspaper headline, you know. If 500 people are killed in a train wreck, you don't say that's a protest article. It's just a factual explanation of what happened. Well, all the lyrics in Eve of Destruction are just newspaper headlines set to music. Just everybody, just to bring it to people's attention.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting?
Let's talk about that sentence we just heard. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting.
Well, at the time, you had to be 21 in order to vote in the United States. And yet you could be drafted at 18 into the Army. And so they could teach you how to kill and go out and kill people, but you couldn't vote. And so that became a focal point. And he actually, Phil Sloan, the guy who wrote the song, told me about this, that I think it's the 26th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was written as a result of that line. And they changed the voting age from 21 to 18. They didn't change the draft age. They didn't raise the age of people to send them out to die, but they lowered the age of people so you could vote when you were 18. So that did change the Constitution, that one line in the song.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, I don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
They really show where the society is at the time in its mental makeup, where we are socially around the world, what we're thinking, what we're feeling, what our joys are. desires are, what our hopes are. Music expresses all of that.
As more and more U.S. troops were sent to Vietnam, the reality of the war hit the American public and anti-war demonstrations increased in the U.S.
Hey, hey, LBJ,
where communist expansionism is most aggressively at work in the world today. The United States is therefore prepared to take all necessary steps, including the use of armed forces, in defense of freedom.
Besides an economic crisis and the Vietnam War, President Lyndon B. Johnson's government also inherited the conflicts related to the civil rights movement. More and more black soldiers started to question what they called the white man's war when it was evident that there were too many racial issues that had to be dealt with back home. Therefore, the black movement also did its part, rallying against the war.
Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash.
Backlash Blues. Nina Simone was one of the first female black artists to express her views on the Vietnam War in March of 1967. That same year, in April, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a speech titled Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam.
We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland.
It was later released by a Motown Records label, and it opened the doors for other black musicians to express their concerns and rejection of the war.
So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools.
From 1968, the number of patriotic songs decreased in the U.S., coinciding with a change of mentality within young people that came about during the Summer of Love, the unrest after Martin Luther King's assassination, and the explosion of the anti-war movement. At this point, the new wave of patriotic songs was more about protecting the soldiers in war rather than supporting the U.S. government. Approaching the end of January in 1968, during the Lunar New Year or Tet holiday, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces launched a coordinated attack against a number of targets in South Vietnam. The Viet Cong managed to seize South Vietnam's national radio station. The plan was to broadcast a tape message from Ho Chi Minh calling upon the people to rise up. But a technician contacted the transmitting tower, cut them off, and instead played waltzes from Vienna and songs from the Beatles.
There's a rush. They're rushing the embassy.
That's fire coming from the other side of the street now.
Outside the embassy.
This was known as the Tet Offensive. A major escalation and one of the largest military campaigns of the Vietnam War. After it, the horrors of the war were becoming unignorable, and public support for withdrawal from Vietnam increased progressively.
nobody, but I must if you so.